Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Here we go. We're back. Another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, one of your hosts, Marvin Smith, along with my good friend, my good buddy, Alan Cardoza. Alan, are you there?
I am here and enjoying every bit of it.
I can't see you.
Oh, sure you can.
Oh, you're only, what, 2 feet from me? Anyway, as we always do, Alan, as we always talk about, you know, the great works that happen here on Answers for the Family is so great. You know, each week, you know, we will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases, outright entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and much, much more. With each of us having over 30 years of experience, wow, Alan, over 30 years.
Well, not only have we had over 30 years experience working with at-risk youth, but we've known each other for about 30 years.
We don't want to tell everybody how young we are. I mean, what, you're 30, I'm 30, so we've been knowing each other.
Well, exactly. We were in the same birthing area.
Okay. Yeah. 30 years. There we go. Good. You look great at 30.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but over 30 years of experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and to work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep your family, Alan, and mine, and our guest mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. And to make this place, what would we say?
A better place for all of us.
Yes. We continue to bring you some of the top incredibly talented and concerning and caring people each week as we bring you what?
Answers for the Family.
Okay. Our topic today is defending children's rights in adult court. It's interesting.
Absolutely.
I have a question for you, Alan. Defending the rights. I mean, first of all, why are we trying to defend the rights of children in adult court?
I think from my standpoint, as far as, you know, what we do in transporting teens is helping to defend those rights, because what we want is that we want to be able to bring them to a place where they can get help. And now, unfortunately, you know, at least my belief is our penal system really spends too much time dealing with punishment and housing and not enough with rehabilitation and education to allow people to come out and become better citizens.
I so heartily agree. And as I look at it, as we, you know, transport and escort these teens to these programs for various reasons,
mm-hmm.
At least from my experience, I know in yours, I see personal results of kids not returning back to their ways. I see development and growth. I see them going on with education. I see some of these kids becoming some very prominent individuals, because there was somebody or some entity that was caring enough to get them off of that track and mm-hmm. not become a lifetime criminal. And I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I really believe if we don't look at this from the short-sightedness and look at the bigger picture, if we don't do something, we're spending a lot more money on the back end with recidivism and everything else of not dealing with the issues on the front end.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It really comes down to education and starting early. You know, if we focus on that, and you as an educator yourself, I'm sure recognize the fact that if we can work with them early, show the importance of education, show how that education translates into jobs, into having a great life. If we can show that, we're going to reduce the population in our prisons rather than seeing it increase as we've done now for many years.
Well, you know, I say it very simple. Prevention versus intervention is so much more prominent. But for some reason, we're in a system that always wants to deal with it after the fact. I don't know. On one hand, it could be very disheartening. But, you know, the other side of that is I see the work that we do, and day after day, we're seeing lives. Well, at least we're doing our part. And I think there's a lot of other people out there doing their part as well.
Absolutely. And that's the thing with the programs. And actually, a couple of stories that come to mind for me, one of which that relates to you. And I'm fortunate to be the one that receives the calls from the young people or from their parents when everything has gone well. So, you know, it doesn't mean I don't get some sometimes when it doesn't go well, but the part I enjoy most is the ones that I get when everything goes well.
Hey, real quick, but you know what they say, he who wears a crown has a heavy head.
Well, the calls that I appreciate the most are the ones when the parent or the young person calls many years later and says, I just want to let you know that you played a very small part in what I now see as a very successful life. So, you know, they'll tell me about the decisions that were made at the transport level or at the locating them level, mm-hmm. and how that, by getting them to that program where they could receive the help that they needed, has now allowed them to have what they believe is a very productive life. One story that's one of my favorites is a call that I received on Thanksgiving, and that was a young man who called to say, I'm calling those people, I'm sitting here with my family, my extended family, and we're all going around the table, and we're calling those people that we believe had an impact in our life and that we are thankful for.
Wow.
And I was so blessed to feel that they chose to call me and said that I had had some form of impact in them feeling thankful. And it was great. He started the conversation with, you probably don't remember me. And I said, well, let me tell you something. There's not many people I had to locate three times, so I remember you very well. But anyway, so I think that's the real benefit. That's the part where you know that you're making a difference. But it also points to kind of this topic, and that is the fact that do we want these kids to go into a prison system, or do we want them to go to a program somewhere where they can get the help that they need? And fortunately, our guest today, who is the founder of the Colorado Juvenile Defender Coalition and was its first executive director, she's going to be able to tell us a lot about that. Now, in her career as a juvenile defender, Kim Dvorak represented youth in juvenile court, criminal court, and appellate court, specializing in the defense of children prosecuted as adults.
And she also litigated the constitutionality of prosecutional direct file in Colorado Supreme Court and spearheaded comprehensive reform to curtail the prosecution and jailing of youth as adults.
Now, Kim presents continuing legal education workshops across the country on juvenile law, litigation strategies, and policies that improve the treatment of youth.
Wow. In 2009, Kim was awarded the Robert E. Shepherd Jr. Leadership Award for Excellence in Juvenile Defense by the National Juvenile Defenders Center and was appointed to the Juvenile Justice Task Force of Colorado Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, as well as Legislative Task Force to Study School Discipline. You know, when you're talking about school discipline, I figure if you can get them early,
yep.
you can deal with that discipline. You know, real quick, I don't believe, this is my take on it, if kids are engaged, and this, if we start talking about the neuroscience and everything else, mm-hmm. and it's humans, it's just human. If a person is engaged, There's no discipline, because there's a focus. If there is a discipline issue, then they're not engaged in the subject matter.
Yep.
Majority of the time. But, you know, until we're in that perfect world, until then, we have to deal with subjects like this. And it's great to have somebody like Kim as our guest.
Kim, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Marvin. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us, Kim.
Yes. And, you know, we, as you can tell, you know, we work with at-risk youth. So when Jan told us, you know, about the opportunity to have you on the show, we were really looking forward to it, because I think that you are dealing with something and hopefully kind of reversing a trend that's not been good for our youth.
Thank you. Yes, I think in Colorado we've made great strides reversing sort of the 1990s punitive philosophy around youth and engaging in what you've described as a more developmentally informed system that focuses on, you know, youth success, which ultimately improves community safety.
That's great. That is good. Well, maybe then Colorado can lead the way, Kim, as, you know, as the model for the rest of the nation, or especially in some of these high crime areas where teens are involved in being part of the penal system that are being tried as adults.
That certainly is our hope. We're trying to spread the word about the significant reform we implemented in 2012, how successful it's been, and how it really hasn't hurt the community. It's only provided more opportunity for youth in our state, which hopefully will spread across the country and help create a new trend toward providing more programming and developing for all youth.
So, Kim, how many states have passed laws that keep most youth offenders out of adult jails and prisons?
Well, there's been quite a number of reforms passed over the last 5 to 10 years that have taken sort of various bites at the apple. Some states are removing children from adult jails while they're waiting trial. Other states are giving youth the right to a hearing in front of a judge on whether or not they should be tried as an adult. Other states are looking at sentencing reform to create a new sentencing structure for kids that doesn't simply apply the adult system. So there's been many different avenues and venues for reform across the country that are really catching fire and helping spread the reform nationwide.
Well, let me ask you this then, Kim, which I think is really great. Well, prior, to educate our listeners, you know, prior to the changes in Colorado in 2012, well, how could a young person be prosecuted, you know, as an adult in Colorado?
Well, there were two ways in Colorado that a young person could end up in adult criminal court. The first way is considered the traditional way that youth have been sent to adult court, and that's called judicial transfer, where a child is actually in a juvenile court system in front of the judge. The prosecutor files a motion, and there's a hearing in the juvenile court with witnesses and evidence and testimony about which system the child should be prosecuted in. That is considered the judicial transfer method. In Colorado, we also had what is called prosecutorial direct file. And so if a youth met certain age limits, if they were 14 or older, and they were accused of certain offenses, the prosecutor could completely bypass the juvenile system and simply file the case in the adult criminal court as if that child were an adult, and move the child to an adult jail, and from that point, there was no right to appeal, and all adult laws applied to children.
Wow.
Now, how did that prosecutorial direct law, or that direct file law, change?
It changed in four major ways. The first is that we narrowed the eligibility for which youth could start in the adult criminal system. So we raised the age to 16. So now only 16 and 17-year-olds could start their case in the adult system if they are charged with a certain offense. And again, we narrowed the eligibility to those very most serious offenses. And then for those kids who were allowed to be prosecuted in adult court, we gave all youth the right to what's called a reverse transfer hearing, so that it wasn't the end of the story when the DA filed the paperwork. That child's attorney could file a motion to the judge asking the court to consider sending the case back to juvenile court. And those are the hearings we're having in Colorado today, where we are allowed to present witnesses and evidence and make our case to a judge that the case should be sent back to the juvenile court system. We also eliminated some of the mandatory minimum sentencings that were applied to kids in the adult court, and we expanded options for juvenile sentencing even after conviction. So we sort of looked at each stage of the case and created more opportunities for juvenile treatment and more opportunities, you know, for that kid to have a future and not simply be sent away to the adult criminal system or the penal system.
Now, Kim, you mentioned the most serious offenses. I mean, for those people out there listening that, that really haven't ever been in this situation, haven't had their kids in this situation, and hopefully never will have their kids in this situation, what are those most serious offenses that you're referring to?
Well, the top two most serious offenses, and in Colorado they're called a Class 1 and a Class 2 felony. That would include first-degree murder, second-degree murder. It would include kidnapping. It also includes the most violent sex offenses. So it would include, you know, rape and kidnapping. Those types of offenses are now able to start in the adult criminal system. And then there's sort of a second tier of more medium-level offenses that could be prosecuted as an adult, but only if the child had already had a felony adjudication in the juvenile court system. What we had seen before is that while people thought direct file was reserved for the most serious repeat offenders, that in the course of our research, that was not the case. And so we wanted to make sure that if this was a first offense, if this was a child who was charged with maybe a medium-level offense but had no prior juvenile record, that those cases really should start in the juvenile court system.
You know, Kim, my thought is you know, and correct me if I'm wrong or maybe just add to this. As I'm listening to what you're sharing, you know, when I look at Class 1, Class 2, you know, murder, second-degree murder, when is a, because we're talking about kids, when is a kid lost? I mean, to the point where there is no rehabilitation. I mean, even, I mean, when you start looking at circumstances and you look at murder and even some of these other crimes that we would call heinous, I mean, you know, at a young age, we'd have to really start looking into the background of that child. Because I would just think, you know, either the guy, either the young person is just a monster, or there's other things that are going on around that child.
That's an excellent question, and I think that's the question that we're now asking courts to consider with these hearings around which system the child belongs in. But one thing we do know is that psychiatrists are not allowed to diagnose a child with antisocial personality disorder or something that would indicate they are lost.
Right.
If they're under the age of 18. And that is why, one of the reasons why the United States Supreme Court in three different decisions now, 2005, 2011, and 2012, has said we cannot deem a child lost if they are under the age of 18. That we, even if they are convicted and sentenced for the most serious homicides, they're still developing. And their brains are not done cooking yet,
yes,
so to speak. And so even for those most serious cases, we really ought to give a second look to determine whether they've reached levels of maturity and rehabilitation that we might not have anticipated when they were teenagers.
Right.
Yeah. And Kim, I think you bring up a great point because, you know, at that point, if we're taking, and I can't believe when you said it was a 14, you know, that at one point it was 14, to take a 14-year-old to put them in adult court, have them be found guilty, and then put them in to an adult population, I mean, what else are they going to learn? In other words, if you have a brain that is now still, as you say, cooking, why are we going to put them into a situation to where really the only things you're going to be able to learn or add to that are really not going to help you, you know, versus, you know, being able to go out to a specialized program that maybe deals with the specific issues that maybe put you in that situation. At that point, if there is still a chance, if there is no lost child, it just makes so much more sense to put them in a specialized program where they can get help on that particular subject.
I completely agree. And, you know, we consider that to be kind of a public health approach,
yes,
to juvenile justice. Yeah, it's an approach that follows science. There was a new book published recently called The Age of Opportunity by Lawrence Steinberg, who is a renowned researcher on adolescent development and the juvenile justice system. I just had an opportunity to buy the book and have it signed by Mr. Steinberg over the weekend, and he speaks to adolescence as being the last best opportunity to wire a child's brain in the right direction. That the moment of adolescence is such a heightened level of brain development that we're going to be wiring that brain one way or the other, depending on how we respond to that child. So we can, you know, wire it for good and give them opportunities and give them programming that can help them develop into the future, or we can, you know, send them to what folks call the College of Criminality, right. Send them to prison, and wire their brain in ways that will make the community less safe when they get out.
You know, it's interesting that you share that, because, you know, one of the things I think about, you know, looking at all the research and look at all the science, and I you always hear me talk about on the show neuroscience, how, you know, this whole thing about neuroplasticity, how the brain is constantly, you know, that old saying that you now can teach a dog, what's that old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, you know, but we're seeing that now the brain can be rewired. But in the research is showing that as the older we become, it's just harder. There's a lot more work that has to go into the rewiring. And my take on this is, if we do the wiring correctly in the beginning, we don't have to rewire. We just keep building upon the goodness. It's like common sense. And B.F., you know, the famous psychologist, B.F. Skinner, he always said, you know, the brain is like, it's like a blank sheet of a paper, you know, tabula rasa. And it's what we put upon it is what it will become.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think we're hoping that people will see that that is of utmost importance, and that doesn't mean that we can't hold children accountable.
Yes.
But we should impose accountability and punishment in a way that is developmentally informed. We can still teach youth lessons, we can still teach them the errors of their ways, but we don't need to, you know, throw them out and throw away the key.
Right. And here's, for me, another thought. I mean, from my insight and my understanding, it seems to be that, and this could be a firestorm, that socioeconomics has a lot to do with who is being persecuted in the system. And it seems to be that, you know, I see socioeconomics where you look at, you know, urban communities, kids of color seem to be in the system a lot more. And to say that, my father was the director of education for Youth Authority. So I grew up with this mindset. He was, you know, over education. And I used to always say, Dad, why are we trying to, you know, wait till they're in the system to educate them? If we did a better job on the front end in the traditional system and educated the kids, we wouldn't be dealing with it on the back end. And his comment was, it's a calling, which I had no clue what that meant. But now as I'm older, I understand. And as he said, somebody has to do the work. And so this is their last opportunity. So we got to do the best that we can. But I don't know, going back to what I originally said, it's just, when I look at the bigger picture, the urban communities just seem like there's some major issues.
And that is certainly the case in Colorado as well, which people may not realize across the country that we do have Denver and we do have Aurora and some fairly big cities. And when we did our research, we studied 1,800 cases over a 10-year period, and that's exactly what we found, is that the youth that were in the adult system that received the most harshest punishments were overrepresented by African American and Hispanic youth. You know, you just look at our juvenile justice system at the lowest end, we see that white youth, Caucasian youth, are five times more likely to be offered diversion,
right.
A disposition that eliminates their case from the juvenile court altogether. You go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, and the children serving life without parole in Colorado are two-thirds Hispanic and African-American youth. And so we really are over-punishing, particularly when it comes to incarceration,
uh-huh.
Youth from African-American and Hispanic communities. And you're right about the other systems as well. You know, I've been representing direct-filed youth in trial and on appeal. And they are, nine times out of ten, the youth that fell through the cracks of the other systems, of the mental health system, of the child welfare system, of the behavioral health system, even the juvenile justice system. You know, they're often the youth who just were never given the appropriate interventions. And hopefully today that will be changing because we know a lot more about what works for children, but we tend to hold these youth accountable at the end of the day when the systems that failed them all along are not quite held to that same standard.
Right, right. And I even, you know, take it one step beyond being involved in education reform. And that's kind of, you know, last 10, 12 years has been an area that I've spent a lot of time, and I continue to advocate because I'm always with the mindset along with Alan, whatever we can do being proactive is so much better. And when I start to look at, you know, even kids within the system of traditional education, we start looking at IEPs, individual education plans, and we start to see kids who have the opportunity through placement, through mental health, and the special ed side of it, are these kids that are, the majority of the kids that are going to programs are, you know, are not, when you start looking at low socioeconomics, they're not kids of color. And I talked to Alan about this all the time ago, you know, something's just not right through the process. And that's why we continue to do what we do and then advocate for what's right.
And we need to let people know these are all of our children. You know, I think a lot of what drove the prosecution of youth as adults was this myth that they are the super predator and
yes.
They're coming to get you and your families. And, you know, adolescents and teens have really been demonized in the media. You know, they're more likely to show African-American youth if someone gets arrested than a white youth. And so it's just created this perception in the public that those youth are the other. They're
right.
The bad kids, and we need to protect ourselves, when in fact they're part of our community, and their success or not will impact all of us. And so we really try to be very intentional about saying these are all of our children, and all of our systems depend on their success as much as our own children and our families.
And I think you said that so well, because you're right. It's been this whole notion of the super predators. I look at from a media standpoint, sound bites and images, which has created this fear, and fear now all of a sudden we're starting to base decisions off of not logic, not what's real, but what I'm in fear of, which is in the back of my mind. So I make these decisions based off not what the reality is, but the fear that's driving me. And we got to be very careful, because that fear is taking us in a direction that is not good. And, you know, at the end of the day, if we're going to compete on the global marketplace, we need all our kids, every one of them at the table with their creative mindset, looking at the future as our leaders forward. So I commend you on the work that you're doing. And we're going to take a commercial break for about 30 seconds. And Kim, hold on. We'll be right back.
Yes, we will be right back. And we have a caller that called in. And that's Larry Levine. Are you with us? Okay. If you can give a call back during the commercial, that would be great, and we will get you on. You are listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
We are back, Answers for the Family, and we are here with our guest, Kim Dvorak. And Kim, I just want to say we appreciate you, all the great work that you're doing out there, making this place, making this world, making this environment a better place for our young, I call them our little people, our teens. And, you know, in teens, you know, all the science is showing that our brains fully do not develop to like age 30, especially for the male. So, you know, I know I have a son. I have a few sons that are kind of up in that age, and they still do stupid stuff, you know. But I go, what's – so anyway, we know the brain is not fully there, but thank you.
All right.
And thank you.
And, Kim, we have a caller on the line, Larry Levine. Are you with us? Okay. I'm not sure exactly why, but anyway, if you can please call back, and we will bring you into the call. So in the meantime, Kim, what are the was there any particular instances or things that occurred that told you that it was time that these changes needed to be made?
Well, we certainly were working on direct file reform in Colorado since the mid-2000s. I had a case that went up on appeal. I think it was described in the opening comments that was challenging the prosecution of youth as adults in Colorado. And that case was resolved in 2007, and it really shed light. It was a published opinion by our Colorado Supreme Court that shed light on some of the problems with the direct file statute. And so that really helped propel reform in the legislature. And we were at it from 2008, 2009, 2010. It was really a five-year process to try to get reform this significant passed in Colorado. So I think what helped was the United States Supreme Court decisions, Roper v. Simmons, that outlawed the death penalty for juveniles in 2005, the Graham v. Florida decision in 2011, the Miller v. Alabama decision in 2012, both of which dealt with life without parole. All of those Supreme Court decisions really put the science front and center and talked about adolescent development and what we know about our youth. And so we really learned over time how best to create this reform by using science, by using data, and by breaking down the myths and the fear of these kids. And just we learned to go from anecdotal debates to, you know, data and research-informed debates. And I think that's what really helped pave the way for success for our efforts to reduce the prosecution of youth as adults.
Well, it's amazing that you share that. And I'm always amazed when you start talking about, as you shared, Kim, you know, data, results, evidence, you know, this whole evidence-based inquiry and understanding, you know, making informed decisions. You know, we'll do this in business, but now all of a sudden when we start looking at, you know, I even look at education, and this is the whole thing about reform. Why are we not looking at the data, and not just a bunch of tests to be testing, but the data that's evidence-based, that we see that there are results? And, you know, I think it's more political than it is anything else. Sometimes it takes a while for the law to change or for policies to change because of, you know, we've been rooted in these elementary anecdotal ways of how we do things, and it's the process. But in that, but in those terms, we lose a lot of kids. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, sometimes it's like, it's like a big battleship turning the corner. By the time it turns the corner, we've lost a lot of lives. But, you know, the fight goes on for what's right.
And that's the case that we found here. You know, we have implemented major reform in Colorado, but there are still 1,100 people in our prison system that entered there as a juvenile. The earliest one was in the early 1990s. And so while we are creating great reform for the future, I think we need to do more to take a second look at some of these young people that we wrote off years ago when it was the politically fashionable thing to do.
Now, you mentioned that there's 1,100 in your Colorado system. You know, I did a little bit of research. Is it true that there's over 250,000 young people that are in the system now throughout the United States?
Yes. Now, the national figures are that there are 250,000 youth prosecuted in the adult system every day across the country.
Wow.
That's just unbelievable.
Mind-boggling.
I know. Well, we have a we have an email that is coming across that I'd like to read to you from one of our listeners. And again, I thank you for all of you that send the emails, that send the instant messages. And I apologize at times for the calls that maybe I don't pick up quite as well on the board. But this one reads, I've been greatly concerned that more and more juveniles are ending up in adult court and so little attention paid to their emotional development during sentencing, especially the 14 to 16 year old age group. What does it say about our society when we appear to lack the ability to care more about rehabilitation rather than just locking them up?
Well, unfortunately, they say you can judge a society by the way they treat their children. But I've found that most people are not aware that this is happening, and that we went on a public education campaign in Colorado, and your everyday citizen, you know, your mom, your teacher, your coach, they're often not aware that this is happening in their own state. These are not numbers that get publicly distributed. You don't hear about them in the media. And so I think when people do become more aware that there are children in the adult system, they are greatly concerned. And most people do believe that these kids are not developed yet, that they need a chance. And when you look at, there's been some national polling done on this issue, you know, the majority, overwhelming majority of citizens nationwide want children to be rehabilitated. And so it's really a matter of getting our state laws to catch up with the science and the research and to catch up with what the public really wants to see happen to our children.
Now, Kim, do you think that there is any connection to the increased growth in privatized prisons and the political contributions by those that own and operate those?
Alan, you didn't go there.
I went
You didn't go there, Alan.
I went there.
Oh, Alan, that's a... Oh, you just opened up a can of worms.
I went there.
Well, privatization is not an area within my expertise, but what I can say generally is that it has become an industry, whether it's a private industry or a public industry. In Colorado, we spent $250,000 over a 10-year period on creating an adult prison for children. And we had no evidence that it was effective. We had no evidence that the right children were in there. But we were just spending, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars annually to keep a system in place that really wasn't helping kids. And so I think if we all look at what our state legislatures are spending, either on public facilities or private facilities, we're not getting a very good return on that investment when we're putting children in a place where they're going to have less opportunity to be a productive citizen.
Well, and like you said too, Kim, on the back half, we're going to spend a lot more taxpayers' money, you know, just that whole recidivism and in and out and being a menace to society. You know, either one or two things have to happen. Either we lock them up for life, or they're on this revolving door, in and out, in and out. And then some of these things are, we're talking about petty. They could be petty crimes, but it's a system that they continue to revolve around. And if they have no skill sets, then what are they going to do? And then if I'm a youth or a teen that gets out of the system, I have no skill sets, I can't get a job, they ask on the application, have you ever been arrested? If I lie, then they find out I get terminated. So if I tell the truth, I don't get a job. So eventually I have to resort to what? How do I sustain? And now that I'm a little older, I'm a little more wiser. Now I have I've gotten married, I have a kid, and I got to put food on the table. I can't get a job, so because I have no skills. So then I have to resort to some type of action to provide for my family. That's probably not legal. And I put myself back in harm's way. And now if I get incarcerated again, I leave a family without a fatherless family. And the cycle continues.
No, that's exactly right. And we know that prosecuting youth as adults does give them that permanent stain of having a felony conviction, which in some states means they lose their right to vote.
Yes.
They certainly have a hard time getting a job. It can impact them greatly. But even aside from that, having a juvenile adjudication now has increasing consequences. And applications are starting to ask young people, have you ever been in juvenile court? They're not even asking about arrests now. They're asking about juvenile court involvement. And so I think that this is another area where the public doesn't realize what's happening. A lot of members of the public think that when you turn 18, your juvenile record just goes away. It just disappears. And like you said, that's not the case. There are long-lasting consequences of prosecuting children in both the juvenile system and the adult system. And we need a wake-up call to say, hey, what are we setting these young people up for? Right. Are we setting them up for success? Or are we setting them up for a situation that will hurt our community safety in the long run? And, you know, we believe in young people.
Yeah.
And we believe that if all of us as a community wrap our arms around them and nurture them and believe in them, they are going to respond to that treatment and they are going to be successful. But they know when the system has written them off. And
right.
Unfortunately, too many of them have gotten the wrong message that folks don't believe in them. So I think we can do a lot more as a community to nurture and protect our young people and not be so quick to use this criminal system, whether it's in schools, whether it's in juvenile court. But we simply need to change the way we respond to youth in many different venues and avenues.
Yeah.
Well, Kim, I think you bring up a great point, that term, writing them off. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that at that moment in which that child gets written off, there are people out there. There are predators out there. There are people running illegal operation that will use them, that will exploit them,
yes.
And that will use that term saying, well, you've been written off by everybody else. We're your family now. We now need you to do this, this, and this, whatever it is that becomes part of their criminal empire. So we need to understand that it isn't just the fact that you're writing somebody off that has to go now tough it out on their own. It's the fact that there is somebody else out there that will prey on them.
That's waiting for all the wrong reasons.
Exactly.
And that takes me right into we have another listener question, Kim. It says, our son, who is now 16, fell into a bad group of kids a year ago and was caught robbing homes. The family of the other boys hired expensive attorneys and placed the blame on our son, which seems to influence the court to give their child more lenient treatment. We had to mortgage our home to defend our child. We are now faced with a cost of $50,000 more to send him to a treatment facility, or they will put him back in jail. I am very disgusted with the way we have been treated. Another one of those cases.
Those stories are so hard to hear, and like yourselves, we get those calls here in Colorado from parents who are shocked at the way the system turns out, that they thought the system would be fair and that they thought their child would get a fair shake at whatever outcome there might be. And we, as part of our direct file reform, have also included improving our indigent defense systems. And from the time we started trying to change laws, we've also been training attorneys, because it isn't enough to simply pass laws in the legislature. We need to make sure that lawyers who represent children in these very serious cases know what they're doing, whether they're a public defender or a privately hired attorney. And so we've been training attorneys on adolescent development,
yes.
On creative litigation, on sentencing mitigation, on the Supreme Court cases. And I think that's as much of an important part of this issue as the policy change piece, because at the trial court level, in the courthouse, you know, we still need to make a difference for children. And if their advocate isn't in a well-trained position to do that, then you can pass all the laws you want, but that individual child may not get a fair shake.
That is true. That is true. And I am, wow, I'm amazed how fast the time has gone by. And we're down to about another 5 minutes on the show. But when I start to really look at these issues, and when I think about socioeconomics, you know, and one thing, Al and I, we talk about this a lot because, you know, we're dealing with teens and placement and programs. And, you know, I think we do a very great job, at least at our at West Shield, what we do when we pick up kids and we move them from A to B. It's that we don't just transport. We escort them and we look at short-term, I call it short-term crisis intervention counseling. And we're preparing, we do a great job in preparing kids for placement once they get there. Because that's people don't understand, they're being taken out of an environment and then going to another environment. And, you know, for their little brains to kind of wrap themselves around this is difficult. So we make that transition. But one thing I realized that Al and I, we talk about a lot, because we've worked with cases from the affluent to the poor. And the difference is between the two, and I make it real simple, the rich, they have issues like everybody else. They're just able to cover them up a lot better because they have the money to put the fences around everything and make it look beautiful, but it's still there. The difference with the poor is just raw in your face because there's nothing to cover it up. But unfortunately, that being said, those with money have a way to maneuver and to work through the system. It's a fact of reality, unfortunately.
No, I mean, I think that these private families can hire a lawyer immediately and get assistance before a case is even filed, try to prevent a case from being filed, whereas young people who are indigent have to wait until a case is filed before they can even apply for a public defender. So just being able to immediately respond and pick up the phone and call a lawyer and have them act on behalf of your child makes a significant difference, and that's just not something that's available to all our children right now.
Well, that is so true.
Yep. Kim, we have another an instant message comment, I guess. It's a comment and a question. This one reads, I have listened to the show for the last few months and find it very informative. I think it's great that Alan and Marvin therapeutically take troubled teens to these special schools and programs for help rather than put in jail. But rather than focusing on how to punish these kids longer, why can't more of them go to the places I've heard about on this show that seem to want to help them become better people? So I guess the question then to you would be, is there a mechanism, you know, for these teens other than their parents hiring somebody to say, can't my child go to this program instead? Is there a mechanism for everybody that is being brought to that to where there's at least an option? If, for instance, they're on drugs, is there an option to go to a treatment program? If they're dealing with a psychiatric issue, an option to go to a specialized therapeutic program or school that deals with that?
Well, that certainly is the goal of our organization and of juvenile justice advocates across the country. We are all working state by state to change our juvenile codes, to change the system, to make them more developmentally informed and more developmentally appropriate. And ultimately, we would like to see the money that's saved on long-term incarceration or even long-term residential care. If we're saving money by keeping children out of those more severe consequences, we should be reinvesting that money on the front end.
Yes.
We should be reinvesting that money in school programs and mental health programs and all of the like that we know are evidence-based and will help keep children out of the system. So I would hope that across the country, all of us who pay taxes will insist that our government treat children differently and put the resources in the places that are best designed to serve and rehabilitate them.
Well, Kim, could not have said it any better.
I was going to say
you.
The same thing.
Thank you. I would love it if we could have a copy of this, maybe just that last 2 minutes that you said, so that we could get that to every person in the legislature to listen to that. If we can get that information out, and for anybody listening, if you know somebody, get that information out. That's the difference that we want to make. Kim, thank you so much for coming on the show. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Again, for everybody out there listening, thank you for listening. Keep listening to Answers for the Family, and we will continue to bring you guests like Kim that can educate and empower. Kim, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Marvin and Alan, and thank you for the work you do for our young people.
All right, thank you, Kim.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.